Welcome, and thanks for joining us at Hangar 46, the Air and Space Power Centre's podcast for the Royal Australian Air Force. At Hangar 46, we discuss a range of topics from emerging air and space power challenges, international relations, technology, ethics, culture, and so much more. We have an impressive lineup of guests. I trust you'll find them informative, at times provocative, and most importantly, entertaining. If there's someone you think we should invite to Hangar 46 for a chat, please reach out and let us know. Find us online at Air and Space Power Centre. Thank you and enjoy the episode.
Greetings, podcast listeners. I'm Sergeant Peter Madigan, Royal Australian Air Force, Airfield Defence Guard. Today I'm here at Hangar 46 joining Group Captain Sleeman as co-host for today's episode.
Good to have you here, Pete. Thanks for joining me in the hangar. This year marks 30 years of service in the Royal Australian Air Force for today's guest, who, like Pete, joined the Air Force as an enlisted aviator with a security forces background in 1994, prior to commissioning to the ground defence as an officer in 1997. Since then, he's led a full and rewarding career in the Air Force, reaching his current position as the Deputy Chief, which commenced in August 2023. Air Vice Marshal Harvey Reynolds, welcome to Hangar 46.
Thanks, Salamo. Good to be here. G'day, Pete.
G'day, sir. Good to see you.
See you again.
Right, to start, sir, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who is the person behind DCAF?
Yeah, okay. So understanding we have some international listeners, for the Brits listening, I was born in the UK. So we emigrated as a family sort of in stages through the 80s. So my grandparents came out first. We came out in the early 80s just after the America's Cup victory. And I came from the south coast of England, a town called Bognor Regis, and you're welcome for the UK visitors because that is, I don't know, for some reason, people laugh about Bognor Regis. It's kind of got a weird sort of, a weird back story. It's always made fun of in British television. I don't know why to this day. Moved to Australia, settled in a town called Rockingham, or a city now on the west coast, which is near Fleet Base West. So, you know, went to school, all through primary school, high school there, down by the beach, near a Navy base, and probably the last thing I wanted to do was join the Navy, so that's one of the reasons I ended up in the Air Force. But that's where I started. Only child, so no brothers and sisters. Had some cousins that I was pretty close with growing up that lived near me. Grandparents, obviously, who came over from the UK as well. And that's where I spent my school years. Didn't go to university. That's a funny story we can come back to later. I went to TAFE, did lab techniques. So I'm actually a qualified laboratory technician, which is not coming in handy very often. But when I'm measuring stuff at home, I do tend to be a bit strict on getting the right quantities of everything, which tells you a bit about my OCD. And then joined the Air Force in 94, as you mentioned, as at the time it was the Ready Reserve Scheme. And one of the reasons that I was attracted to that is it was like gap year these days. You could do a year up front and then you got study assistance or employment assistance. So it was quite a good deal. But the only job you could do was Airfield Defence Guard. So it wasn't that I was drawn to Airfield Defence Guard necessarily, but I got the recruiting pitch that so many Aggies get of, do you like skirmish, do you like camping, I've got the job for you, which I said yes to those things. Turns out, don't do those things really when you join. And that's what got me into the Ready Reserve Scheme, which was 12 months. And I thought, well, I'll have a look around first for a year and then decide what I want to do after that. Loved it, applied for a permanent contract, and I guess the rest is history.
Fascinating, sir. I've got a question to come back to you on that, as which Ready Reserve base you went to. But yeah. Coming out of high school, sports, interest, performance through high school or interest through high school, how did you track that?
Yeah, so high school, I was the average student. So I was pretty average through most of high school. I think most people that say school's the best years of your life, it depends on your experience. I found high school relatively difficult. Simply because, depending on how you learn, a lot of those dense topics and subject matter, some people will pick it up quicker than others. So I found English I was really good at. That was my strongest subject. But some of the advanced applied physics and maths I struggled a bit more with, which probably makes sense as to my career choices as well. It's sort of drawn down that pathway rather than some of the STEM-heavy engineering type area. Played cricket. Played Aussie rules football, got into martial arts pretty young as well, and cricket was probably my favourite sport, probably continues to be, but I don't really play it anymore. Never got really good at any one sport though. I sort of bounced around, and I've done that most of my life. I like variety, so I tend to move between things and never got to higher levels of competitive sport. Started work, my first job when I was 13, as delivering newspapers, and always loved working. So, yeah.
Thank you. Going into the early parts of your career, sir, considering coming through as an airfield defence guard and then going through your commissioning process, can you talk through that early phase of your career, coming out of the Ready Reserves, where you were based, and then the motivation for shift and change, and how you found that pathway?
So I guess what drew me to the Air Force initially was I had two grandfathers who both served in World War II. One was an engineer and one was a bomber pilot. So on my mother's side, my grandfather, he flew Boston bombers in Europe in World War II as a flight sergeant. So he was enlisted air crew. And that sort of attracted me to Air Force over the other services. And then when I sort of explained the reasons why Air Force Defence Guard initially, it seemed to be the only job available for Ready Reserve, did that, enjoyed the job. And what I enjoyed about it was just, as most of us did, the amount of time you spend outdoors. It's physically active, it's engaging, you get to do a lot of exercises and deployments. And I found that very rewarding. And I continued doing it because I made such a close-knit group of friends that I really enjoyed that sort of camaraderie I experienced. And that sort of continued going for a while. Then I found that I was starting to feel like I wanted to make a career in the military, and that I was more attracted to more of the planning and more of the strategic aspects of the job, and less... Once you've done the enlisted level basic stuff, not that it's basic, but you know what I mean, the enlisted experience, I found there was something missing, and that I wanted to challenge myself in a different way. And I was sort of looking at, as I did my NCO training, should I continue doing this or should I commission? And I made the decision to commission. I wasn't sure if it was the right move at the time, but I thought, well, I'm going to regret it if I don't try. So I applied for commissioning, I was accepted, and went through the Royal Military College through the Army General Service Officer course, as we all tend to do as ground defence officers. And again, I was enjoying being an Airfield Defence Guard. I just wanted something more. So it seemed like a natural fit for me to commission into the same workforce rather than try something completely different. So that's what got me through that way.
Now, sir, I first crossed paths with you back in roughly 2000 as now 2SEC4 was returning from East Timor.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk us through your experiences there as a junior officer and how you found that coming out of the RMC training pipeline into that role?
Yeah, it was it's funny. So I think a younger aviators may relate to this, but I'm finding out as my staff keep reminding me they relate less and less to my old stories. But, prior to East Timor, what people need to remember is we hadn't deployed since Vietnam on its scale. Obviously, there was Somalia in 1991, and they had been deployed in Rwanda. There had been deployments with the Army. Relatively limited in scale, and Air Mobility Group have always deployed all over the world, obviously, and same with Surveillance and Response Group. But in terms of large-scale deployments with multiple services, East Timor was really the biggest thing we'd seen since Vietnam. And a lot of us didn't think anything was going to happen. In the 90s, there was this element of frustration where a lot of the younger people wanted to get out and deploy, and they didn't think they'd have the opportunity. Then East Timor comes along and we deploy pretty much the vast majority of the Defence Force in, at one point or another had done it. And I found it rewarding, but it was extremely challenging. What you got to remember, being a flight commander at the time of an Air Force Defence Guards, in an Air Force Defence Squadron, you've got about 30-odd males at the time, not more diverse now, but all between the ages of 17 and sort of early to mid-20s, and your NCOs are mid to late 20s at the oldest. And I was pretty young too myself. I think I was still my early 20s. And for the scientists out there, the male frontal cortex doesn't develop until mid-20s. So all the problems that go along with with bored young males deployed in a security role in an environment that turned out to be fortunately a bit more benign than we were expecting. We went over expecting quite a kinetic and high threat environment. It wasn't the case, fortunately, and I think partly because of how good a job Interfet did in setting the security conditions early on. But as a result, we had a lot of people doing a lot of good work, but a little bit underutilized, and some of the boredom and wayward behavior I had to deal with as a junior officer there was actually quite beneficial for me as a leader. I wouldn't say it was always fun at the time, but having to deal with challenges that involved early was really useful for me as a leader to help sort of develop. And being stuck overseas away from family, this was pre-internet, obviously. There was occasional mobile phone access. There was mail, but there was no email. We were living in pretty Spartan conditions, even though we had it better than most people in East Timor. So that created a lot of leadership challenges on how do you keep your people motivated, how do you stop them getting bored and complacent, because we still had a serious job to do. So it was great. I will never be complaining about being bored again after that deployment. I read a lot of books. There's a lot of downtime, and it's often the way with operations that earlier on in your career at lower ranks, you have a lot of downtime, and I found that to be part of the challenge with leading in that environment. And then we came back and moved on to sort of other leadership challenges. But I think having that experience early in my career really helped me as a junior officer deal with complex personnel challenges early. It helped me later in my career.
So you go back from Timor, sir, and from there you started to progress up through the ranks. And in that time, you started to achieve a lot of firsts that hadn't been achieved before. So can you talk us through sort of the second half of your career?
Yeah, so the first half of my career is a pretty traditional ground defence sort of career. So I got back from East Timor, went to a base, went to Tyndall, and was in charge of sort of the ground defence and training and some of the base security at Tyndall. Moved into security and fire school and came back to help run the ground defence training there, Air Force Defence Guard basic courses, NCO training, officer training. That was a really good job. Went to the executive officer of an Air Force Defence squadron under a couple of different commanding officers. Went to combat survival training school as a chief instructor, which was awesome, great job. And much to my surprise, I then got promoted way before I was expecting it. So just as I was hitting my stride as a sort of flight attendant at ComServe up in Townsville there, great job, like I said, promoted and then put in a staff job, and I really struggled, I must admit. I found that challenge, and I think a lot of us do, really difficult. I lost my sense of purpose almost immediately, and I found that quite confronting. But around the same time, a friend of mine, now retired Air Commodore Dave Patterson, who about to be retired, I think his farewell's coming up, gave me a call and said, hey, we're trialling a special operations capability in Air Force to support two commando regiment at the time. And I said, I'm in. I'm looking for something different. This is not what I want to do at the moment. And already being a squadron leader, he said, hey, I need one squadron leader. I need someone to be the flight commander for this thing if it ends up. But there's no guarantee it'll be successful. We've got a lot of challenges ahead of us. And even if it is successful, we can't guarantee it's going to become a capability. So I said, I'm still in. I'll give it a go. Made a couple of similar calls myself to other people that I knew and trusted. And the first group of us got together. So the second half of my career then was really a transition point into the combat control capability and helping establish that from the ground floor. Special operations, integrating air power with largely commando force elements overseas as part of Operation Slipper in Afghanistan initially, and then capability, sort of building that combat control capability into what is now Force Squadron was sort of the next few years. That took me into Air Combat Group because that's where the capability was. And from there, I sort of got to know Air Combat by default, given we were so closely integrated with them, that became part of my world as well. So I had the first half in combat support, then got to sort of work in Air Combat Group, but in quite a specialist area of Air Combat Group. And that gave me a completely different challenge, which I found really rewarding. And then also got to work with Special Operations Command. And that sort of culminated with 2 jobs ago, I got to do a 2-year exchange in the US as a Deputy Director of Operations in US Special Operations Command at Tampa. That was awesome. So to be trusted by Special Operations Command to go and represent Australia in that job was fantastic. And I can't say enough good things about Special Operations Command. They integrated us as Air Force members really well early on, and they were very surprisingly welcoming, actually, of us and our capability. Yeah, there was friction early on at certain points, but once our people sort of proved themselves on operations, they just embraced us, and it was really rewarding. Still some of the best highlights of my career have been through that experience, but I've been very lucky that I've had sort of 2 careers. And then after that, it's been into, you know, sort of staff roles and deputy roles.
And the job you had in the States, we'll come back to that in a minute. But as you went through the career, your career, like I said, you had a bunch of firsts. So you're the first non-aircrew CO of a flying squadron.
Yep.
Chief of Staff, Air Combat Group, Deputy Air Commander, and now DCAF. First, again, non-aircrew in those positions. How have you found that? Is there any particular challenges, or has your just generic training that the Air Force provides its people set you up well for those roles?
I think it set me up well. One thing I'll correct is Dave Patterson was the first non-aircrew CO of Force Squadron. He was two COs. He was the first CO when it reformed, and then there was Stu Bellingham, who was a forward air control pilot before me, and then I was, and it still continues to be largely a combat control CO these days. And yeah, as you say, first Chief of Staff of Air Combat Group at the time that was non-aircrew, first Deputy Air Commander and first DCAF non-aircrew. Look, I have tried not to focus on that too much. I just try and do a good job. But the challenge has been learning and absorbing as much as I can about what everybody does around me. So, and what I mean by that is Air Combat Group is an extremely high performance and relatively technical environment in a lot of ways, and I had to absorb a lot of that in a different capability and learn as much about it as I could, because when you're representing the commander or you're representing a number of units and capabilities that you haven't actually come up through yourself, you need to be able to speak with a degree of confidence. But I've always been very conscious of my limitations. I don't expect anyone to think I'm an expert in being a fighter pilot. I don't know the first thing about it, but I know enough about the capability that I know what value it can bring. I know enough about how we operate as an Air Force that I've always managed to learn that quickly, and that's one of the things that I've been very fortunate that I learn quickly. So that has helped me. But I've never felt too intimidated by it, and the reason for that, I guess, is because people have always been welcoming. I've never felt excluded. No, at no point. There's always the occasional comment, well, as a non-operator, you wouldn't understand this or understand that. I don't take offence to those comments. Usually it's just someone not really understanding my background. But it's an opportunity to educate people. So you can't afford to be intimidated when you're someone who's the first of type, because I'm always conscious of, if I do a good job, I'm going to open the door for a heap of other trades and categories and backgrounds of people to do the same thing. And that, to me, is far more motivating than me doing a good job. I'd rather open the door for a heap of other people so they get the opportunity, and the diversity we've been talking about in the leadership group will continue to grow. And we all know diverse organisations are stronger. It's just, you know, it's been pretty decisively proven a number of ways over the years. And it's hard to do in the military because we have a very, by default, our culture has common values and common traditions and norms. So. Yeah. I found the Air Force has really supported me my whole way through the journey. If I need help at any point, there's always someone there that's willing to stick their hand up and help you out. And that's one of the things I love about our service. It's very collegiate, and everybody's there to support each other.
And talking about supportive, you said when you're in the States at the US Special Operations Command, there was a very supportive environment there as well. Can you tell us about the role you had? I'm guessing you were the first Air Force officer to hold that position. So can you tell us about the role you had there, what you learned, and any lessons you can bring back to Australia?
That's a good question, Slimo. I was the first Air Force officer that Australian Special Operations Command had sponsored, but I was also a very known quantity in our Special Operations Command. So they all kind of knew me pretty well, and we got along and everybody trusted me. So that was very fortunate that I'd had that prior experience with them operationally. And in the US Special Operations Command is extremely joint. So it's actually very hard to remember which service you're talking to a lot of the time. Everyone wears the same sort of multicam uniform. Everybody's from different services. So you have, you know, Marine MARSOC Raiders, you have US Air Force, AFSOC Special Operators everywhere, you have Army Special Forces, you have Rangers, you have Navy SEALs, you have the whole lot. And my area in operations, so the Director of Operations at the time was a helicopter pilot. He was a Special Operations pilot from AFSOC. The Deputy Director, shout out to JB if you ever hear this, I hope you do. This guy, he retired as a combat controller in 1972, 2 years before I was born. He's in the Combat Controller Hall of Fame. He deployed to Grenada and all these really early combat control operations. He's a US national treasure. He's now still the Deputy Director of Operations there as a civilian, and he transitioned out of the military in, I think, about 2001, 2002. So he's been there since early days of Special Operations Command. He was the other deputy, and then there was an Army deputy as well. So there was three of us that worked as a team. And the Army one-star Brigadier General, he was Green Beret, so he was Special Forces. So actually we had quite a few Air Force people in that team. So it wasn't that unusual to have an Air Force Deputy Director of Operations. In fact, there was probably, if anything, too many Air Force people in the front office, and we were constantly trying to work out how can we bring more of the other services in on the next posting cycle. So I actually found that pretty easy to adapt because I had, and special operations forces tend to have fairly common languages, just like we do in our air forces. So we know how to, you know, it's very easy to pick up what people are talking about. I will say though, the US military, they take jargon to professional, major league jargon to a new level. I was not ready for some of the acronyms that were thrown at me when I got there. Which was fun because I always had to stop people and say, what does that acronym mean? And sometimes they wouldn't know. But yeah, I guess what was the job? There was a lot of global force management. So Special Operations Command, the J3 there does a lot of, gets requests from combatant commands for SOF, and then we work out how to assign forces. I was involved in that process. I was involved in other types of special operations like information operations or military information support operations, MISO they would call it. And it used to be called PsyOps, but probably no misleading term in the modern environment. All sorts of interesting stuff. And got involved in J3 International, which is a big international fusion cell they have there. So as the senior sort of international rep in the headquarters, I was expected to be involved in everything they were doing. And lessons I would bring back, I think everybody has their resourcing challenges right now, globally, especially Western militaries. And I saw that in US Special Operations Command. There's not enough SOF to go around for the demand signals that are out there. And I always had to remind them at the time of their budget and the size of their forces. But it's still a problem. Like, so the demand signal's bigger, they're bigger. So they have similar challenges to us with finite budgets, challenging missions, too many places to be at once. And they have all of those usual challenges that come along with that. I would take some lessons also about how integrated they were from a SOF perspective. Like I just alluded to, there was a lot of special operations and non-special operations people in their headquarters. They didn't necessarily have a background in SOF. And it was very hard to tell in some cases who was SOF background, who wasn't, which service they were from. And to me, that's what an integrated joint force looks like. It's really hard to tell. You don't want everyone to be homogenous. That's not what I mean. But it was a very cohesive team, and I found that very compelling and really rewarding to be part of.
So that's you in the Special Operations Command headquarters. Instead, half the reason you were selected to go there was you're a known quantity, you'd been working in that area in Australia. Can you talk us through any memorable deployments or missions you've had as part of Special Operations in Australia, or out of Australia, sorry?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the first deployment I did with Special Operations Command, and I'll talk around anything that obviously gets in things we can't talk about in a free-to-air podcast, but my first deployment was with Commando Force Element, but I actually started in the Force Command Element above that. So it was a headquarters. I worked in the J5, so I worked at the planning cell with an Army friend of mine, Sean, who's still serving. And I basically assisted him with some of the operational planning. As the only Joint Terminal Attack Controller qualified officer in the headquarters, I was there for any sort of support that needed to be done remotely. So if we needed to coordinate things remotely out of that that headquarters, which was dislocated by distance from the elements that were in the field, then I could perform that function. What ended up happening, unfortunately, there was a mission where Corporal Jason Marks was killed in action in the Commando Force Element, and there was a number of casualties, and one of the casualties was unfortunately the Joint Terminal Attack Controller in one of the Commando platoons. And as a result, I was expecting to do a headquarters job for, you know, a 6-month deployment, and then got tapped on the shoulder and said, hey, we need you to get out field and fill in for the platoon JTAC, because the platoon was halfway through, or the company rather, the commander company was halfway through their deployment cycle. So rather than send forward someone else to train up, they just sent me into the field. It also acted as a validation of the training that they'd put us through to that point. So because I'd had all the commando training, not every single course, but the majority, so I'm not saying that the commando training is exactly the same, it is slightly different for us. But did the vast majority of it, and then I was deployed outside the wire. I didn't have any equipment with me at the time, so I had to re-zero a rifle the night before that. We went straight back out on to the same area where the ambush had, well, not really an ambush, but where the enemy action had occurred, where Jason was killed. We went out there pretty quickly, and I had to come up very quickly with an offensive support plan to support that that operation at platoon level, and bond very quickly with a platoon of commandos who just lost a friend. That was quite a challenge, but again, they embraced me pretty wholeheartedly. Some of them had trained me on my in my commando training. And we got after it pretty quickly, and that was but I still remember, Pete, some of the equipment I had, you would laugh and probably throw up in your mouth a bit at some of the rigs I was running at the time. I had a bug out day pack that I bought from the BX for $30, and that was carrying a Taxat radio, a couple of camelbacks, all my food, grenades, you name it. It was nearly falling apart. I couldn't get all the right equipment because we just didn't have the time. So it was really challenging, but we got there. I managed to go down the Q store and convince them to give me some more stuff. I had the wrong rifle, so they gave me, because I wasn't SOCOMMAND at the time, they gave me an F-88, but I was qualified on the M4, so I had to switch my rifles out and zero it in the field and all these fun things. Great experience. The platoon was awesome, and the company was awesome. And, one of the highlights of my career, just getting to support some of our best soldiers that we can produce was fantastic, and very challenging, very physically demanding, obviously, but that's what I wanted. And I got that opportunity and got a similar opportunity to deploy back, but with a company headquarters level, but from the start as part of the company on my next sort of rotation of Afghanistan. So I did two deployments with them, but then moved on to staff roles and more senior things, which you would expect me to be doing at that rank. So
as that squadron leader, in the assuming squadron leader, Tom, sir?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
So that squadron leader in that environment, at what point did you get that past your own and, you know, having talked to some of your previous employees in that fourth squadron space, get that sense of ownership or validation where not just yourself and some of the officers in the initial phases, but the rest of the team then going through and then becoming, I suppose, relevant and, you know, value-adding within that SOCOM environment under Task Force 66?
Yeah, I felt a lot of pressure early on, I've got to admit, in that capability, because it was operationally demanding and we knew we were up against it in terms of resourcing. We didn't have a lot of time to get ready to deploy people, and a lot of our guys had to keep backing up, doing frequent deployments early on as we were trying to grow the critical mass. Getting people through the commando selection and training course and the subsequent reinforcement cycle was a challenge. We had to bring Air Force people in from all musterings and categories and train them up. So we had a dual responsibility of doing our own sort of screening and preparation training, so that they would have a higher degree of success through the commando pipeline, in addition to deploying and then force generating the aviation specific skills we needed. So it was really challenging early on, and I found the operational work challenging, but I found it much harder dealing with how to grow a capability at the same time. So I made a very deliberate effort early on to understand my role, and I still say that these days, and the staff cringe when I say it, but you know, if it's cringeworthy, it's probably worth saying on a podcast, right? I know how to play bass guitar. I know my role in the band. I'm not the lead singer. I'm not the vocalist. We've got a chief of Air Force. My job is to support the chief. Similarly, my job at the time was to grow the capability and to resource it and to make sure it had what it needed. My job wasn't to be out on operations. I had to do that early on because we had limited numbers. As soon as I had done that and we had enough people coming in behind me, my focus very quickly on equipment, employment category development, training, all the other stuff that's the boring stuff nobody wants to work on, but that was the greater challenge. And ultimately it was the more rewarding effort long-term, because we look at the capability as now we've got more than 50 controllers that have got grey berets now. And I was part of setting that up, and that's immensely rewarding. My personal experience on operations, personal performance is almost irrelevant. I think the team effort is what motivates me now. So, and that's a hard part in everyone's career, right? Where you've got that immediate gratification of seeing, you know, you're coordinating an airstrike or you're coordinating, you know, whatever you might be doing, and you see the results directly. You've got to switch that mindset eventually at some point in your career. It's my job's now to invest in others, and I may not see results for years, but I know they're coming. I've got to have faith that they're going to get there, and then 5 or 10 years they'll be in a better position because of that work I did that wasn't necessarily as exciting as what I joined for, but was just as important.
If I can ask a couple of questions about the Defence Strategic Review, not going to the nuts and bolts of it, but just a few of the outcomes. The review talks about moving from a balanced force to a more focused force, focused on the Indo-Pacific, so our immediate region. This has caused a lot of changes to the force structure, and there's going to be more to come. What are your thoughts on where the Defence Force is going and any additional changes that we can expect?
Such a huge question, Slimo, and there's way better, smarter people to ask that question to, but I'll give you my perspective. As I try and keep my world as simple as I can most of the time, but it was a change that was overdue. It had to happen. We are a middle power. We don't have a large military. We don't have the budget or the population base to support a large military. We're invested in fairly high technology, high skill set military that has niche roles that it's exceptionally good at. How do we repurpose that force to achieve the maximum strategic deterrent effect regionally in the Indo-Pacific and look after our strategic main effort area of interest rather than be diluted globally? And I think the government made a courageous but the right decision to pursue a focused force priority because we had no choice. And you could see it already during the years in the Middle East. It's an important region, and of course we're going to be involved there in the future and we continue to be. But if you overdo your global contributions, you leave very little in reserve, and our ability to shape and influence locally is therefore limited. We weren't out in Southeast Asia and the South Pacific as much as we should have been during those global war on terror years. And as a result, you know, we're now having to rekindle some of the relationships that were so strong before that, which is great to see happening. And for us, I think it's a different challenge, but it's still a challenge. Getting out into the region is what we need to be doing because I do believe like the ADF is a force for good in the region. We do a lot of good work out there, and I've seen it firsthand, humanitarian aid, disaster response. We culturally well attuned normally to the region. We come in, we're generally there to help, not to take over. And I think that is a compelling way to use our military. But more broadly, again, we've got finite resources. We need to deploy them where it matters most for our national defence. And I think that's what the government's done. That's what we need to focus on. Where do I think Air Force needs to be focused? What I'm excited about is us getting back to the north of Australia. In the 90s, people would remember, we were up there all the time. We knew all those airfields like the back of our hand. We knew exactly the ways in and out of those bases. No one was getting in there unless we knew about it. We need to get back to that. That was our battle space. We owned it. We felt comfortable up there. We knew the locals. We knew the local government. We worked much more in the region and projected power from the north of Australia. That's where we're going again. Nothing new about it. We did it in World War II. And I think it's a good thing for our Air Force, but it creates some unique challenges for our aviators. It's going to be less medals. There's going to be less overseas conditions of service. Sometimes, not always. There'll still be plenty of regional opportunities to get overseas, I hope. But it's just a different set of challenges.
So as part of the DSR, there was a Defence People System and the establishment of the Chief of Personnel. Noting previously DCAF was the lead within Air Force on the personnel realm. How has this changed your role, and you know, what positive effects have you seen coming forward into that?
This is a really interesting area, and I would continue to work through this with Head of Military Personnel and my counterparts in the Military Personnel Organisation, but a lot of work to do. But for bottom line, starting at the bottom up, from our aviators' perspective, hopefully nothing changes for them in that their career manager they pick up the phone and call should be the same person. I'm still invested as an accountable officer to the chief for workforce outcomes, but it's more focused on what is domain specific. So what are the aviation retention initiatives we need to look at? What is Air Force culture going forward? How do we evolve it and continue having that conversation under the broader defence cultural blueprint? Those are the sorts of things that I'm expected to look at. Training is still, you know, we still have to manage our initial employment training, initial military training, inside Air Force training group within Air Command there. So some things haven't changed and some things have, without mystifying the changes. Some of the positives out of this, you asked me what are the positive results. I think the discipline it's going to have to bring to the system is good. What was happening before was each of the services, for good reasons, we kept creating what we call establishment, so jobs. We would create new positions and say, hey, this unit needs to be reinforced. We're going to create another 10 positions. There may not be a budget for it, but we'll just carry the risk of doing that. And as a result, over time, we grew the middle of our workforce too much. So we created too many supervisor positions that we couldn't staff. Then we were undermanned and we were reporting that we were undermanned. But we'd actually done it to ourselves by creating an unsustainable demand in our workforce. The reason that happened is because, as I said, we're reacting to bottom-up valid demand signals, but we were managing it the same way every time by creating establishment and then struggling to fill it. I think the other services had similar challenges, but I won't speak for them. But when you magnify that and multiply it, you end up in a situation where you're not designing the force from a top-down prioritised perspective. And what's happening now is the Vice Chief of the Defence Force, instead of the service chiefs, has the authority to create new workforce demand signal, which allows a bit more control over what's done. What it does make it more difficult for, for us to do is just to sign off on, like I said, creating new units or reorganisation. But it forces a bit of discipline. So we can't just keep reorganising things or changing things or growing establishment if there's not a valid reason to do it. So I think that's actually good for us. Is it going to be painful sometimes? Sure. But no worthwhile change is easy. And I've found that the integration so far, the opposite numbers, there's still a lot of the same people that I work with in the personnel, former personnel branch, now military personnel organisation. I still talk to them all the time. And they're still responsive to what we need. So for the aviators out there that are worried, don't be worried. Like, we are still getting the outcomes we need. The business processes we use is that's for something for me to worry about. And they're being established right now. So the DSR directed it to all happen pretty quick. It did. We moved everything quickly. Now we're working out what the enduring processes will be. But that's a normal change management process that we'll go through there. But the good news is I think there's a lot of good work to come with under Chief of Personnel's organisation on how we can do top-down prioritisation better, but also how we can standardise a bit better between the services. Because if we don't have a bit more standardisation and we're moving aviators into space and cyber, for example, and the whole joint force and integrated force are doing that, well, what are the rules? So each service will bring their own perspective. But if you have too many rules for such a small force, if we can't fight competently in space and cyber, as the Chief's already mentioned, we've got no business being a modern military. We need to get better at that. So that's the biggest benefit I think we'll get is enhancing the space and cyber domain effectiveness.
I've got a question about culture, sir, and I think it'll lead nicely into a follow-on question that I know Pete has on ethics. You mentioned when you joined up and you led a force of men, as they were in that unit at the time, to Timor, a bunch of young men. How have you seen the culture from that service then, which wasn't overly diverse, to what you're seeing today? And you, for example, in your position, and the Chief mentioned that we have, he promoted late last year, the first 2-star air battle manager, mm-hmm. first 2-star intelligence officer. So it's a much more diverse force today. What are the changes you've seen and any benefits or anything to do with that?
Yeah, it's another big question. I could talk to you for a whole podcast on this because I've got a lot of thoughts on it. But I'll make a couple of things clear. I think the Air Force I joined was an excellent Air Force. And I take nothing away from the people that served during that period of time. That was the culture we had at the time. None of us created it. We inherited that culture and we did the best we could with it. But when I see where we've come from and where we continue to go, I'm convinced that we're moving in the right direction. If you look at the diversity of some of the teams we're seeing out there, there's an element of strength that comes with that. And some of the perspectives and ideas I've been able to come up with, you know, as my career has developed, has been largely due to that changing demographic. People are far less afraid of telling me their ideas now than people would have been. Like the idea of talking to the deputy chief when I first joined was an alien concept. It wouldn't have happened very often, especially in our line of work. We were so disconnected, and I know we still feel disconnected from Canberra out there in the broader Air Force sometimes, and that's I do feel that still myself. But I think what's changed is people feel a lot more comfortable to speak up now when they've got an idea, when they think they can solve a problem. I'm never the smartest person in the room. The answer's always out there. It's just asking and listening. And I do think we have an organisation that listens to its people more than it did. Is it enough? It's never enough. That you always need to evolve. It's always hard to evolve as fast as the pace of change demands. But we're genuinely trying. And when you look at the chief, the current chief and Air Marshal Hutfeld, they're walking the talk. I mean, they promoted 3 security force background officers in a year. None of us had ever made 07 before. In fact, when I commissioned, I think I'm pretty sure I had to sign a condition of service saying, I acknowledge my ceiling rank as Wing Commander. And here I am as Deputy Chief of the Air Force. Like, we have changed and it is coming. Like that diversity. And I know there's people out there that are impatient for it to go quicker. It's coming. I do think it's changing. And I have noticed that the range of skills I've been able to develop as a leader is directly as a result of the different people I've been able to work with and the different experiences that they bring to what we do to deliver air power. It absolutely has made me better. To stay with it, if that culture had stayed static and it had been that all-male work environment focused on that one area, I just would not have developed the range of skills or leadership that I've managed to do through that broader exposure. So I think we're on the right path there. But the Chief's not after a complete change to the Air Force culture, as he said before. He's happy with it. He's interested in how do we evolve it? How do we keep progressing and hardening the edge of the sword. Like, how do we get better as a warfighting organization? The two are linked. I was talking to the staff the other day about this, about the cultural blueprint. I'm less worried about what a flowchart says or what a diagram or schematic says. I want to know what a squadron thinks about it. And what I want, you know, the squadrons and units to think about is, have you actually thought about your culture? So when you take away your procedures, your TTPs, your manuals, what are you left with? When you're unsure what the rules are, what do? That's your culture. That's not just driven by the leader. That's driven by everybody in the unit, and they all have a part to play. And if we think about how we do that and how we can be better, we will become better at warfighting, and we will become better at delivering air power. It's not about diversity targets. It's not about incident reports. It's not about chasing metrics. It's about becoming more effective as a fighting organization. And culture is intrinsically linked to it. If you look at the best sporting teams in the world, if you look at the best high-performance organizations, they all talk about culture. That's no accident. So I think that's a conversation we need to have. Part of the problem is sometimes we don't use the right language when we're dealing with the workforce, and we confuse them, and then we lose them because they don't want to hear about corporate messaging. They want to know how it's going to make them better. And that's, I think, the conversation we need to have.
I think you've actually pre-answered part of the question there, sir. But having just come out and spent 3 years instructing at ADFA, we talk a lot about the new ADF leadership doctrine. We talk a lot about, you know, leadership journeys and ethical dilemmas. How have you approached this? And what are the lessons that you'd like to share with us from your lessons in the ethical side of leadership, stepping away from, I suppose, the modern administrative managers into that leadership and genuine messaging and creating that culture? You know, what advice would you give to the young aviators and also the young officers over at ADFA and RMC and OTS right now?
Yeah, again, I could talk a long time on this, and I'll try to resist the temptation to bore everybody. So I'll give you an example of an ethical dilemma I've dealt with in my career, and there's plenty of examples out there that are equally or more compelling than mine. But I remember my first deployment to Afghanistan, supporting that commando platoon. We had a enemy contact situation at night, nearly arrived on a target. There was a couple of insurgents neutralized, and then we had what we call chatter. We had a lot of intercepted communications indicating that there was enemy force massing to sort of to follow up that contact and sort of engage us from one of our flanks. At that time, I asked for a couple of aircraft from the company, Joint Terminal Attack Controller, who is an artillery officer, really, really good guy, friend of mine to this day, Ross, if he's listening, g'day, mate. He pushed me a couple of more aircraft than I needed. Actually, it was great. He's very generous. And one of them actually pretty quickly found a large group of people. And the way it was described to me on the radio is really interesting. They said, we are seeing a group of fighting age males moving tactically towards your position with large objects. Now, under the rules of engagement at the time, that was probably sufficient to establish hostile intent. But I couldn't really talk too much to the platoon commander. He could hear the communications. I was right next to him, and I sort of shook my head, and he agreed. And I decided just to keep an eye on them for the moment. I had plenty of support with the aircraft types I had available. I had a second aircraft check in, look at the same target, and they said, no, that is a family with children. Do not engage. I said, okay. So I switched the two sensors around, and in the second aircraft that joined late, I got them to track what they were designated as a family, and I got the first aircraft to actually sanitize around the platoon so we could move to the next target and clear the way there. And I never really knew, but at the time we weren't taking fire. I didn't feel an imminent threat, and we had a bit of advantage of that and night fighting equipment, and the platoon commander and I quickly said, yeah, we don't need to do anything about that. We'll keep an eye on them, and if they are an enemy force, we'll deal with them when we need to. The lesson out of that is I've told that story to a few people since when we're talking about rules of laws of armed conflict and rules of engagement. Technically, could I have authorized an engagement of that? Well, it's up to the ground force commander. He wasn't convinced, but we could have if we decided that was the right thing to do. We didn't need to. So just because you can, it doesn't mean you should. And when we got back to the base after that mission, I asked for someone to pull the tapes on that target, and it was a family with children. So if I'd engaged, I would have murdered a family with children. That's how I would have viewed what I did. I'm immensely grateful that, again, I had a very level-headed platoon commander. We didn't feel immediately threatened at the time. It sounds like a common sense decision now, but when you've just had an enemy contact in the middle of the night, it is an easy situation to misjudge. And that restraint is a key part of that judgment. It's hard to get right. And what I'd say to our aviators is you're going to make mistakes. Things are going to be confusing at times, but there are skills you can acquire to become better at these sorts of decisions. And that's why I talk about culture. When you're not sure what the rules are, what do you do? That is a cultural question. That's not something, there's no right or wrong answer to a lot of these questions. But this is what I encourage you to explore. And for the junior officers out there, you've got to know your team, you've got to know yourself, and you've got to know your mission. And you've got to do all three. You can't just do one. And knowing yourself is probably the most important part of the equation. I could go beyond that, but we'll run out of time. But those times will come in your career when you have a dilemma and you don't know what to do. Don't wait for that to happen and surprise you. Start building the skills and knowledge you need now, because you can upskill yourself as a leader and get better. And if you make mistakes, but you were trying to do the right thing and you're acting in accordance with our values, then we'll support you. If you're undermining our values or you're trying to do the wrong thing, well, it's a different conversation. But in my experience, that's quite rare.
Just segue that, sir. I think the bit you're probably understating there is level of fatigue involved in that process. And, you know, I'm assuming you weren't minute one into the mission when you were faced with these decisions. You know, so to that end, hard training. Can you look back upon your service and the incredible profile that you've had, and look at a moment in time where the hard training, that thing that you did, that ridiculous exercise and that ridiculous pressure and preparation, where you saw validity in that and you had that moment where it clicked and you thought, whilst I hated that instructor that was standing over me in that weapon pit or tell me to charge up that hill, it's paid dividends now.
Absolutely, Pete. I can think of so many examples. And but before I give these examples, please don't take these as things you need to reenact, okay? So I did an exercise at Royal Military College. They still do it now. I think they changed the name of it. I think it's called Shaggy Ridge now. At the time, it was Exercise Timor. That was prior to the deployment to East Timor, and understandably, they changed the name to avoid confusion after that. It was run by a couple of SAS officers when I did it, and they did a spectacular job of setting up a really, really difficult exercise, but it was very well run, and it was completely... The instructors were largely in character, except for a couple of your directing staff that were attached to you and assessing your leadership. It was very limited food, very limited sleep for 5 days on the end of a pre-fatiguing sort of 3 weeks offensive operations training as staff cadets at Duntroon. And I performed, my self-assessment was I performed poorly on that exercise. Probably some of the lowest performance I've ever offered in my career. I found it extremely challenging. The hallucination from the sleep loss I wasn't ready for, the hunger I've never experienced in my life prior to that point. This was pre-combat survival training, just so you're aware. So I know a lot of Air Force people know what hunger feels like because they've done CompSurf, but at the time I hadn't, and I was not ready for it, and I found it extremely challenging, and I struggled to perform well as a leader. By the end of the exercise, I was just starting to realize what I needed to do differently and how to manage myself better. Later on, when I went through the commando selection training course, the sleep deprivation happened. Because there's elements of it, you've got to expect it in that type of training. They're not going to take it easy on you, and I don't want them to either. I was more ready for it because of that exercise, and my performance, I think, was much better. I knew how to manage the fatigue. And unless you've experienced it, you don't know how to manage it. You don't know what the warning signs are, and you can't self-correct. So, I think there's a place for tough training in our Defence Force. There's publications on it now. There's policy on how to do tough training. The risk management processes we have these days are much more mature, but you need to really think about how you're mitigating risk to your people, because we can't afford to break people in tough training. But it's how everyone joined for a challenge. So it's finding that how far can I push people so that they go a little bit further than what they're comfortable with, so that the growth happens, but not far enough that I break them. And I've been fortunate enough that I think the instructors on some of those early training courses I did knew that limit better than I knew it myself. So they pushed me well past where I was comfortable. It felt like it was probably double what I was comfortable with, but they knew exactly how far they could push us without breaking us. And they did that. I wasn't injured. You know, I had some minor issues at the end. You know, my feet got swollen up a bit. I had blisters, but that's what happens. I benefited immensely from that training, and it's held me in good stead throughout my career. I had a very tough commanding officer. You would probably remember when as a junior officer, I struggled. I got some pretty direct and harsh feedback early on, but that's what I needed at the time. I benefited from it, and nearly everything he said to me was right. It's not delivered the way I do it these days, but those early interventions, when they happen, they're confronting and they push you out of your comfort zone. But you got to remind yourself, am I here to get better? Am I here for a challenge? Or am I here for an easy time and a nice 9-to-5 job? And if it's the latter, well, okay, but that's not necessarily the military offering. That's we need you to go above and beyond every now and then, but it is very difficult to, it's very hard to get right. So when you do see training done well like that, it's hugely beneficial. But I take your point, Pete, that it's not everybody gets the opportunity and it is difficult to do properly.
Okay. Apologies, sir. Havoc 06 was sold out. However, I'd like to discuss a book, which is by Colonel Christopher Hughes, who's now a brigadier retired. He's written a book called The War on Two Fronts, which discusses his role in the 101st Airborne during the 2003 Iraq conflict and being an aggressive force, battalion commander in an incredibly hostile environment, and then concluding that 1 year deployment and then coming back to the Pentagon and working as a colonel in the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So looking at your career profile and then looking at your current role and having run into you preparing for Senate estimates in recent days, how do you reflect on this in the war on two fronts in that, you know, you've gone from being that battlefield commander or the, you know, incredibly involved in the battlefield to now being, you know, very torn between Russell officers and Parliament House?
Look, I'll start by saying that I think the Chief did a fantastic job and so did Head of Air Force Capability at Estimates. Fortunately, I haven't had to do it, but I have done some private briefings and they're challenging. And yeah, look, you're hitting on a good point there, Pete. I know where you're going with this question. I did find the operational environment, and a lot of us will relate to, a lot of people out there listening will relate to this. That's what you're trained for, you prepare for. You join the Air Force visualizing yourself on operations. And when we get there, we think this is awesome. I don't want to stop this. At some point, the dream will end and you have to do something else. And I found some of the bureaucratic inertia that you'll run into when you're trying to get, you know, resourcing or equipment, or I alluded to some of it earlier with the combat control journey, it's really hard. And I found that much more frustrating than I found operational challenges. You've got to be patient. You've got to actively listen to people. You've got to understand the processes that they need you to follow. It's very rare that someone's coming to work trying to do a bad job. They're just different perspectives. And you need to understand how to adapt the skills and knowledge you have to different environments to get the results your team needs. And so I remind myself in Canberra, it may be tempting for me to respond a certain way to a stimulus or to deal with something. I've got to remember who I'm representing. I'm representing a force that I have huge respect for. I think our aviators are the best aviators in the world, person for person, hands down. And if I do a bad job of how I represent them, that's going to have impacts on other people. I take that very seriously. So while it is tempting sometimes to get frustrated with, you know, these sorts of different environments, you've got to be able to adapt. You've got to adapt. It gives you a new challenge too. If you get good at something new, there's always reward in it. It's not always easy. It is challenging, but you've got to do it. You've got to show up. You've got to be present. You've got to give it everything and do the mission you're given, not the mission you want.
Perfect. Righto, moving on to the rapid fire questions to end the episode. So 10 questions, short, sharp answers.
Sure.
Number one, what books are on your bedside table?
Conflict by David Petraeus and Andrew Roberts.
Football or sporting code, team you support and team you despise?
Probably Australian cricket team, and given that I was born in the UK, you probably despise the UK cricket team now, the English cricket team.
How do you keep fit?
I train 5 or 6 days a week, do a combination of kettlebells, air dyne, assault bike and jiu-jitsu.
Fastest PFT run time?
8:15, just after commando selection. Could not do it now.
There you go. Other than Hangar 46 podcast, what do you listen to whilst exercising?
I listen to ASPE, Policy, Guns and Money. I listen to Softcast, which is a US one. I listen to a number of podcasts. I listen to metal when I'm working out, but I listen to a lot of different music.
Favourite holiday location?
Go to in Australia is Jindabyne. The best overseas one I've done the last five years was Iceland. It was spectacular.
Who's better at mowing the lawn, you or your wife, Tricia?
Tricia, hands down. Way neater, way better.
You've been posted to the United States twice. What's your favourite place, Montgomery, Alabama or Tampa, Florida?
I loved both of them. I would have to give a slight edge to Tampa, Florida. I just spent longer there, so I've got more friends there now. But yeah, both great.
Go-to karaoke song?
Well, you'd have to hold a gun to my head for that to even be a possibility. But it had to be something by Sinatra because there's no high notes and it's slow, so it's easy to follow the bouncing ball.
What's your hidden talent?
I don't know if I've got too many hidden talents. I don't know if Pete's got any view on this, but I've got a pretty good memory for pop culture references that are completely useless for anything other than remembering pop culture references. Would you agree, Pete, or have I got any others?
Well, I mean, you opened a pre-dialogue with a lot of Taylor Swift references, so I've got to pay that. And at three times throughout today's conversation, we've gone to the Anchorman, so I agree.
Okay. I didn't realise we got Anchorman three times, so that's good validation of my hidden talent. Thanks.
There you go. Well, so it's been an absolute pleasure for myself and Pete to sit down and chat with you this afternoon. Thanks for your answers. They're pretty frank, clear, easy to understand. So it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us at Hangar 46.
Thanks, guys. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us at Hangar 46. We'll be back again soon for another chat. But in the meantime, follow us online at Air and Space Power Centre to stay up to date.